the absence of American military jeeps and trucks and soldiers, even though they had been pretty much put out of bounds for the city of Hue. There was still enough people, there was enough activity on it.
Did you notice an impact on the local economy?
Well, my favorite story is this: is the rector's secretary, old guy, you know, and he came, not really running, but hurrying up to me one day when he ran, saw me at the rectorate, and said, Mr. Manley, what are we going to do? There's no more TV. And the U.S. had taken its military, had stopped its TV channel. And he was very upset. What are we going to watch?
That's the second best TV story I've ever heard. No, that's the best TV story. My other favorite TV story is a Vietnamese saying, my favorite program when I was growing up was Combat.
Yeah, oh yes, that's true. I'm sure this man would have said, told you that was his favorite story. Or his kids, anyway. He was worried more for his kids. Yeah.
But then what happened in Hue in 1975?
Of course, we left, so I don't know what actually happened. Mm-hmm. We left. There was a lot, for me, there was, I think, in a lot of people, but certainly for me, there was lots of denial, okay? Mm-hmm. So, packed up as if we were just going away for a visit, like 72 again, mm-hmm. and went down to Da Nang. I don't remember if we may have gone in, I may have gone in a helicopter, Jim and I, mm-hmm. but I can't remember that. Mm-hmm. I do remember one of those two times we went down, and a student's family had a truck, and mm-hmm. we went along with them. And we met the rector down in Da Nang, and he wanted to try to organize, because so many of the students were from Da Nang, or mm-hmm. at least had gone there, left there. At this time, nothing had really happened in Hue yet, and mm-hmm. he wanted to try to organize, April 1st, it seems. Mm-hmm. He wanted to organize end-of-year exams so the students could get something to show that, you know, they wouldn't have lost the whole year. So we started in he was getting some classrooms from the community college, which had just started in Da Nang. Actually, now it's the University of Da Nang, it's called. It had just started the year before. We were going to use their classrooms, and we were supposed to start putting together tests, and it was all more or less just a fiction, but at least so the students, we could then say that, and give them a certificate. I don't know what he was going to give them. Mm-hmm. And that's what we were focused on. So that was fine. Mm-hmm. That gave us something to do, that gave us a focus, and this mm-hmm. was our new reality. Mm-hmm. And then we were there until, that was a real, I mean, that we left on one of the pioneer contenders mm-hmm. from the Bay Da Nang, and that was quite a...
Did you ever get to give the exams?
No. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think it got very far along, mm-hmm. as far as being... Mm-hmm. I don't remember actually putting anything on paper. Mm-hmm. I remember I still had a number of my students' final... my seniors' essays, their senior essays. Some had actually finished them already and gave them to me. And I think I have them someplace, maybe mm-hmm. in Boston, in my sister's attic.
I got to write that down. Sister's attic. Okay. Oh no, some people have got boxes they haven't opened for 30 years.
I'm now wearing a sport coat that I wore in college. It turns out it fits wonderfully.
Yes, and the styles are back.
Yeah,
bell bottoms are the next thing.
That was rather.
So you got on a freighter. Essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
And left it, where did it go to?
Phan Rang.
Phan Rang, okay.
And Liu, Jim and Liu, were mm-hmm. They weren't married yet. Mm-hmm. That's one of my, when I always have to remind them. We didn't have very much with us, of mm-hmm. course. And I think I had a big suitcase and a handbag, and I think they had, anyway, our suitcases got left on the beach, mm-hmm. and we just had little handbags. And in my handbag, I had put my, I'll show it to you.
Okay. See, there are important things in your sister's attic.
My mother had made this, uh-huh. and I had known that I could, were I not to rescue this, I might as well forget about going back to Endicott, New York.
Yes.
So I had this And we were all night on
a crocheted blanket.
A crocheted quilt, or a blanket. Afghan, mm-hmm. we'll call it. And
a Nani Nu in my family.
Nani Nu. And we were on the sleeping on the deck of the boat, and it was cold, and we had nothing, and so the three of us slept under this. Mm-hmm. Now, Jim, they weren't married yet. They were engaged, but they weren't married yet. But in order to be sure that he wouldn't be forced, somebody, some bureaucrat wouldn't say, "You're not married, and she can't come." Jim had gotten somebody at the American consulate, who later I worked with at ODP, and Nick McNeil wrote a letter on a consulate saying that they are married. And so he had just gotten that. So I like to tell him that the three of us spent their wedding night under the same blanket.
So talk about your own early departure.
And on the boat, there was this little boy who was about 10 years old, carrying this little tiny dog in a little backpack. And his family he had no family. And it was really, some people were very quite concerned, because apparently his mother had drowned getting out of it. That whole scene up there was really quite horrendous. The panic. You have to remember that there had been such good propaganda through the whole country. The communists will, if the communists come, they will make shoes out of the skin of the people who work for the Americans, and they will pull the fingernails out of, you know, prostitutes and people with, anyone with colored fingernails, they'll pull their fingernails out. I actually remember the street banner about making shoes out of the skin of the figure. Anyway, so there was real panic, and there was these huge barges floating in the middle of the bay, and people would come out to these barges and all these little types of boats, and some bringing their Hondas, you know, because that's your life savings, their Hondas and their any possessions and their aged grandfathers, and there'd be this huge barge, it had no edges on it, no sides on it, floating there, and the Pioneer Contender would go up to it and let people climb. There's just one little ladder. In the meantime, more people were trying to get onto the barge, and there were soldiers coming, and actually the soldiers would come up on a little boat, and in order to get a place, they would fire into the crowd on the edge of the barge, and to make people, give them a way to get on the barge, because there was no room, and people were being pushed off, and people were falling off or being pushed off between the barge and the boat and being crushed as they banged together. And this went on for about 8 hours, 9 hours. It was just horrible. Dr. Cho was there. He was on the boat, and he organized us and a bunch of anybody else. We had like a human chain down this little gangway, so pulling people up and then passing them up the stairs, and just did that for. And I still remember. I still get tears to my eyes, and I think of. I looked down. I was up halfway up this ladder, and I saw one of the he was a philosophy professor from the University of Hawaii with his wife and kids, and he just looked at me like, I've never seen such despair. Never saw such despair in my life. It was just so horrible.
Did he get on board?
Actually, I didn't. He did, yes. And then years later, he was the first person from those days that I met when I was in Saigon in 1990 with ODP. Excuse me, in 1980 with ODP. 80. He was. I had gone to the. You know, this time there were no Americans there. There was one other. There was one American, and I became the other. Nina McCoy was teaching English up in the north with the Swedish Development Project, and I became the other American who were living there. I replaced, actually there was a fellow before me, Michael Myers, who's with the Kennedy Subcommittee. He was the first American with ODP there, and then I replaced him. So there weren't many of us around, and they had a whole street that was just bookstalls. Used books, And this is people have gone all their books and either sold them themselves or sold them to people to sell them. Mm-hmm. It's gone now. They closed that down in the early 90s or late 89. And I suddenly saw him there. He was a philosophy teacher selling books. And of course I didn't dare talk to him. I remember I just froze. I was with this Swiss fellow whom I lived with, he was with UNHCR, John Noel. And John Noel loved books, that's why we were there. I don't buy too many books. I'm not into books. John Noel.
I'm glad it's not there. I would have bought every single book.
Well, John Schaefer has done. Yeah. I hate to even. He got sick when I told him about this.
Oh, and Jay Scarborough, too.
Because by the time John went, of course, this thing was closed. And I just stood there and looked at him. He looked at me, and we didn't talk. We weren't that close. We were about from here to, you know, about 20 feet away. And I just, and he was staring at me. And that's what caught my eye. And I stopped and looked at him. And he just, almost that same look. And he said, "They won't let me teach." And he was looking at himself selling books on, on the street corner. And I was just destroyed. And John Noel was very, very bright. He turned around, he saw what was happening. I don't know if he realized exactly, but he knew that, and he just grabbed my arm, he said, and started talking and walking me away.
Right.
And it was just awful. The tears were coming down my face. He's now in France. He got off by boat. it's awful the way some people's lives. He probably even today wouldn't be so well off because he taught philosophy, and even Western philosophy. He'd never studied abroad, but the French was his language, so he wouldn't have that much to do there today.
Did you, was it Feng Rong you got to?
Yeah, and then by this time I adopted this little boy and his dog.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I figured that had happened.
Yeah, right, okay. Yeah. I think we probably went by Air America down to Saigon, and I think Jim was with us, yeah. And Jim and I together in Liu, we stayed with the British Quakers, who were, I had become friends with. In Truminyang Street, and brought this little boy, and I said, "What am I going to do with this little boy?" And it turned out he was spoiled rotten. And it turned out also that he was about 12 actually.
Uh-huh.
He was small.
He just looked very young.
He looked about 9 or 10.
Uh-huh.
His one dream was to go to America. I couldn't imagine what could I do with this kid in America. And my mother, no, I don't think that would work. And so I was pretty sure that he'd be much better off in Vietnam. So we started looking. Okay, and in the meantime, a fellow teacher from the University of Hawaii, Mi Van, M-Y-V-A-N, Truong Thi Mi Van, T-R-U-O-N-G, T-H-I, M-Y-V-A-N. She was a young woman in her mid-20s, who had gone to college in Canada and had come back. And in Canada, she had fallen in love with this fellow and wanted to marry him. He was Vietnamese, but her parents were very old-fashioned in Hawaii, and they said, "We don't know him, and he's not even from Hawaii." Say nothing about the fact that we've never met him and he's in Canada. So her parents had agreed finally, she was only one of two children, they had two girls, that if she came back to Hawaii for 2 years and still wanted to marry him, they'd give their consent. So of course that 2 years wasn't quite up when this all happened. So Mi Van had come to Saigon, and the Canadians renewed her visa, her residence visa, which she had kept. But she didn't have any way to get there, and she couldn't get passport. So we got a marriage certificate. So actually, this is my great story. I was married, yes, for all of probably a week. And Mi Van did it all. I remember I had to call home and get, my mother sent my birth certificate and that. She had to get her name onto somebody's family book in Saigon. And having done that, I don't remember much of it. We just had to go to this district office and I had to sign my name, and we had a marriage certificate. Turned out we didn't need any of this in the end, but we didn't know that. We had no idea. I thought I'd have to get her, I didn't know anything about immigration, but I'd have to take her to the embassy and do papers. And it turned out, when we did leave, you know, we didn't have to show anything. She was just my wife. In fact, I had had, anyway, so Mivan was helping me, and she had a friend, an old high school friend, who was a pharmacy student in Saigon, and her from Hue. And we went to talk to, for some reason, she had visited her. Okay, and that girl's mother was in Saigon, had come to visit and had gotten caught and wasn't able to go back. But was intending to go back because she had a good business. She made that, I don't know if you know Masung, M-E-X-U-N-G. It's a Hue candy. Very sticky and comes in little squares. And she had a good business. She was well off. And she had no intention of leaving. And she agreed, and she had no sons.
Yeah.
And she thought, okay, she said she would adopt this boy and take him. Phew.
Yeah, otherwise you would have been married and with kids.
And dog.
And dog.
Because you couldn't leave this cute little dog.
No.
This kid, you know, had not been all, he was really spoiled. He was very, and so we took him there the next morning. He'd gone to meet them. We went back, and the next next day I took him back, and we were leaving the next morning. Oh, I know what it was. No, we weren't leaving the next morning. But the next morning, we had gone out early, and we came back to the Quaker house. The maid said that this woman had brought the little boy back. He refused to go to sleep all night long, and refused to eat or drink anything until they brought him back to me.
So he wanted to go to America. Yeah.
And the maid was very smart. She told him that we had already left. It turns out the little brat, he's in England now. Lou Rutt. Yeah. Told her mother this story at some point. Her mother met the little boy's mother, who was never drowned in the bay.
Yeah, I had a feeling. She's still
just
waiting
for
his son to come back.
Just by coincidence. It's really weird. Well, you know, I had gone to Red Cross at some point. I don't know why. Well, anyway, that's
it. Well, anyway, it is a wonderful story.
And he eventually left by boat and got to England.
And thus
I don't
his adopted mother
is.
Frustrating her heir who would take over.
Well, she had promised me that she would go to Da Nang and try to find his mother. So that had happened. She had gone to Da Nang. I mean, she was a very, you know, upright woman. Mm-hmm. And she had gone to Da Nang, found his mother, and then given him back.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And probably by that time, she was very happy, too.
But nobody loves their child like the child's own mother. And, well, we don't have much time, so just for the fun of it, let's say you're doing your resume. You're just telling me, you know, you're reading from your resume. What did you do after 75?
I came back and I got to the States probably in June or May. We left, we did, with Mivan, left by C-130 to the Philippines overnight. And Mivan is very pretty. And she was in her aoyai, and there was a picture of her shown on TV in the States. Of her, she was sitting on this pile of luggage with her little pink parasol, protecting her from the sun. And we got here, and she went off to Canada. She already had her residence visa, so that was no problem. And then later we got, she went to court up there, and we got an annulment. And I went back to Endicott, New York, and then they opened a refugee camp in right outside Harrisburg, at Fort Indiantown. Yeah. So I went down there and volunteered with the Red Cross, and immediately started gaining back all the weight that I had lost.
All that good Polsko kielbasa or something.
Right, that food in that area. And then from that, there was a UNHCR representative in the camp, and he was leaving, so I got a short-term contract to replace him. That was sort of exotic. And then I took a job with IRC from the Camp International Rescue Committee, because I got to know Nan Borton, who there at the camp, and she was opening an office, a resettlement office here in San Francisco, so I came up to be a resettlement worker in San Francisco. And stayed here till 80, when I went to work for ODP.
Hadn't you had the job with ODP?
Nan again. I told you there was somebody else that had gone to Vietnam with ODP for a year in 79, as soon as they signed the agreement in from Geneva, Michael Myers, but he spent the whole year with nothing happening. Mm-hmm. They never actually worked out the logistics of the, I mean, the modalities, they call it, of the program.
For the orderly departure program.
Right, because it was agreed to in principle, not in how it would actually work. Mm-hmm. So Michael spent that whole year in Hawaii doing big, you know, finding things to do, mm-hmm. not doing what he really wanted to do, and that was there to do. And he had to come back. He had put off a fellowship at Columbia, and he apparently couldn't put it off again the second year. Also, his wife was pregnant. So, the State Department was looking for someone to take his place. And by this time, I was director of the San Francisco office, and Nan was living in Washington. She was still with IBS, with IRC at that point. Living in Washington, D.C., and living with one of the State Department officers, Hank Cushing, who is instrumental in pushing ODP to get the State Department to support it. And they needed a replacement, and Nan said, "Oh, how about Tom Melia?" And see, Nan knew about, I was having a call, I mentioned Ko Liu before, who was one of the teachers in Da Nang, and we had known for years and helped us out one summer in this feeding project. Well, Ko Liu and I had stayed in rather indirect contact, and we'd gotten letters back and forth, although I didn't dare write to her directly. She had moved to Saigon with her sister, and I think I had sent her some money at one point, and New Miller took some money to her for me at one point. Anyway, she got out by boat and was in Malaysia, and had written to me, and was waiting to come to the States. And Ko Liu didn't know I was gay. Well, I didn't know I was gay at that time either. And by this time I knew I was gay. And what am I going to do? Here's Ko Liu, who's on my doorstep. And I told Nan this at some point, we were talking, and so Nan, the phone rang, and I picked up the phone, and Nan says, got a solution to your Ko Liu problem. Want to go to Vietnam?
That was close.
And I think I left here in early September to fly to Bangkok, and Ko Liu got to the States in late September, early October, so almost crossed paths. Mm-hmm. And I was in Vietnam by October 10th.
Saved by the double 10th. And you worked on consecutive contracts for the next...
Actually, for that I was hired as an employee. No, we didn't have contracts.
Mm-hmm. But what was the agency that employed you?
Initially it was with U.S. Catholic Conference here in the States, and then they were actually affiliated with the International Catholic Migration Committee, which mm-hmm. is a Swiss Catholic organization, so everything went over to them. So then I worked for them until 1985. Mm-hmm. And the end of 85, I decided to quit and come back to America and start a new life. Mm-hmm. And I left Vietnam, went to Bangkok, and got cold feet. And at that point, I started working on contracts. And, they needed somebody out at the Vietnamese camp on the border of between Thailand and Cambodia. Mm-hmm. And I had always wanted to do that. I had never worked in a refugee camp, of course, mm-hmm. but had been involved
with resettlement camp, but
yeah,
not a
right. But not a real refugee camp. Mm-hmm. So I got a contract with IOM, International Organization for Migration, which is another Swiss but non-sectarian organization. Mm-hmm. They're only in it for the money, we always used to say that. And so for the next 86, 87, 88, up until the end of 89, I would spend about 3/4 of my time at the out in Oranje Pretet, mm-hmm. and about 1/4 of my time at the ODP office doing backup work, file work, and stuff like that. And then in 89, was able to, the State Department authorized me to do immigrant visa interviews, mm-hmm. and so I started going back because they were so short of people, and suddenly there was a big commitment. The State Department made a commitment to take 10,000 refugees a month, mm-hmm. so they needed more interviewers. So that's mm-hmm. I then started doing that full time until last December.
Mm-hmm. And what are you going to do now? What have you been doing since last December?
Well, I applied for a job with INS and the asylum office here in San Francisco. And that took 2 years to go through because I wasn't eligible. I was selected, but then security wouldn't give me security clearance because I've been out of the country too long. Mm-hmm. So that took almost 2 years to work. And again, IRC helped me on that, International Rescue Committee, because they wanted that their liaison person in Washington now is the wife of a former ambassador to Bangkok, Shefi Abramovitz, and, whom I had met but I didn't know. But she's a good friend of Chris Sales, who's an assistant to the INS assistant commissioner to of INS.
I'll remember that next time they say, "How do we know who you say you are? You're not an American citizen." Right. They'll say, "Well, call this person. Right, I know a guy who knows him, who knows the wife."
Right, right, right. And Chris Sales told said that this should be waived.
So now you're working. You're doing asylum interviews. Well, that's a full life there.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not near over either.
That's right. Well, you know, refugee. We used to have this little. It was kind of cynical. Mm-hmm. We used to have this little sign in our office, your suffering is our bread and butter.
I think that sounds like IBS cynicism to me. That's great. I really appreciate it. Enjoyed it. And, you know, there's a wonderful book called Tears.